Another potential candidate with pro-life leanings for the conservative leadership.
It's not likely in the short term that legislation on this type of subject matter would be successful. So are there other areas where we can make inroads? Would it be protecting conscience rights for physicians and nurses? Would it be perhaps a strategy to fund women who are in situations where they feel like they don't have a choice but would like to keep their child? Those are the types of things that I think are achievable in the short term.
On the feature today, an exclusive interview with former House Speaker Andrew Scheer. In the news, it's looking more and more like there's a showdown coming in Alberta's education system over Bill 10, gay-straight alliances, and gender identity. An update on the Trinity Western Law School case, and some new statistics on the first 6 months of legalized euthanasia in Quebec.
And now, Lighthouse News. Lighthouse News is a presentation of ARPA, the Association for Reform Political Action. Here's your host, Al Sebring.
It's September, and schools are back in session across the country. In Alberta, there appears to be a showdown looming over the government's insistence that all schools implement policies recognizing LGBTQ rights and allow the creation of so-called gay-straight alliances if students ask for them. The Independent Baptist Christian Education Society, which operates two schools near Edmonton, is balking at those demands. Education Minister David Egan has threatened to withdraw close to $1.5 million in operational funding for those schools. Board Chair Pastor Brian Coldwell is not backing down.
What people need to understand is that all taxes are not secular. Christians pay taxes also. And the bigger discussion here is really parental choice and freedom of religion. You know, Minister Egan keeps saying that every school board needs to follow the law. We are simply saying, Mr. Egan, the Alberta government also needs to respect the Charter of Rights and Freedoms and also needs to respect the autonomy of local school boards. We should not have to surrender our education taxes if we don't want big government acting as dictators to take the place of God, families, our local school boards, and churches. There needs to be some respect here both ways.
There's two online petitions on this issue, one demanding the government pull the funding, the other in support of Coldwell's position. Last week, Liberal leader David Swan also weighed in on this, calling Coldwell's organization, quote, an antagonistic school board with a strong bias against the LGBTQ community. Coldwell says that's simply not true.
Our school board has a history of 20 years of safe and caring and loving Christian school programs. Never once have we had an issue where a child has been harmed or abused or anything of that nature. There's never been a case of a gay youth or anything ever been harmed. We don't have that type of issue because if the fundamental teachings of the home and the church and the school complement one another as opposed to contradict one another, that minimizes a lot of these issues.
Coldwell says any talk of withdrawing funding from independent schools completely ignores the substantial savings those schools provide to the education system. In other news, the Nova Scotia Barristers Society has dropped any further court action on the Trinity Western Law School case. The society wanted to refuse admission to the Nova Scotia Bar for any graduates of that proposed law school because of Trinity's so-called community covenant, in which students promised to confine their sexual activity only to the bounds of heterosexual marriage. Last year, the Nova Scotia Supreme Court ruled the society was out of line with that request because it violated the principle of freedom of religion. Earlier this summer, the Nova Scotia Appeals Court upheld that lower court ruling. ARPA lawyer Andre Schutten was listed as an intervener in both of those court hearings.
Frankly, I think the Barristers Society's members in Nova Scotia were sick of paying thousands and thousands of dollars to argue for a case that they thought they shouldn't have been arguing in the first place. My hope is that Nova Scotia Barristers Society is at peace with the results that they've got from two courts now. Looking at it from a bigger picture, I'm a little bit disappointed, almost, that Nova Scotia didn't appeal to the Supreme Court, just because I'd rather be arguing on that record rather than on the one from Ontario. I think the Ontario judgments are poorly argued and poorly reasoned.
Schutten says the original Nova Scotia ruling, which made a very strong case for the religious freedom argument, could still be presented in a potential Supreme Court submission.
The Nova Scotia Supreme Court did give us that great ruling, and we can get the Supreme Court of Canada to look at it by referencing it, and you can be sure that should this case get to the Supreme Court from Ontario or from BC, that lawyers for Trinity Western University Law School will be citing that case.
The Ontario ruling is being appealed to the Supreme Court. We're still waiting for the outcome of the lower court appeal in BC. And finally, some preliminary statistics on euthanasia out of Quebec. Late last year, the province passed a law allowing for euthanasia. This is different from the federal law on doctor-assisted suicide. And now we have some initial numbers on the first 6 months of that new reality in Quebec. Sean Murphy with the Protection of Conscience Project has been looking at those numbers.
The numbers show 243 euthanasia requests across the province, of which 156 were fulfilled and 87 not fulfilled.
There are some anomalies there. Murphy says it's important to look at those in the broader context.
The statistics, I think, are primarily useful for identifying questions that should be asked and understanding what's going on. For example, when Le Devoir published a piece concerning the statistics, one of their complaints was that it appeared that many more people in Quebec City region were being given euthanasia than in the Montreal region, despite the disparity in population. And Le Devoir was expressing concern that this was a problem because their concern was that people in Montreal seemed to be being denied euthanasia and that it was easier to obtain in Quebec City. Part of the answer to the question Le Devoir was posing was that there were many, many more euthanasia requests in the Quebec City region than in the province generally.
We've got a link up to Murphy's analysis of the numbers from the Lighthouse News homepage. Back with more after this.
Transgenderism, pornography, and our culture of death. These are heavy topics. Join us this fall on our speaking tour as we share what ARPA is doing to proactively address these difficult and pressing issues. We invite you to participate and help change things for the good. Although the foundations are crumbling, we have hope. From September 26th to October 15th, we will be in Manitoba, Ontario, and BC to educate, equip, and encourage you to make positive change in our political culture. Visit arpacanada.ca for event details in your area.
And we're back on the program. The race to replace Stephen Harper as leader of the Federal Conservative Party is getting more interesting for social conservatives. A few weeks ago, we presented an interview with Saskatoon MP Brad Trost, who is running for the leadership on an unabashed pro-life platform. Another candidate who appears ready to get into the race, in fact, he may have declared by the time you hear this, is Regina MP and former House Speaker Andrew Scheer. His approach to issues like abortion is somewhat more nuanced than that of Mr. Trost. Last month, I reached Andrew Scheer at his Regina constituency office. Mr. Scheer, welcome to the program.
Thanks very much for having me.
Let's start with the general state of the Conservative Party with respect to the social conservative movement. There was a fair bit of angst earlier this summer when Rana and some of the other leadership candidates marched in the Toronto Gay Pride Parade. There was, of course, the change of definition of marriage at the convention. What's your take on the state of the party right now with respect to that aspect of the politics, the waning support, if you will, from the social conservative wing?
Well, I still think there's a great number of reasons for optimism for conservatives, both socially and otherwise. I think what we saw at the convention was a desire to focus on some of those issues that are more achievable in the near term and that all different kinds of conservatives can agree on. So, for example, we saw very good language put into our party platform on protecting conscience rights. We condemned the practice of gender selection. So I think there's a realization that there are a lot of different types of things that conservatives disagree on, and lots that we do agree on. And, you know, we can make more progress if we say, okay, well, what are the issues that unite all different kinds of conservatives? Let's focus on those and try to achieve them.
You're perceived as one of two social conservative candidates when it comes to questions like abortion and gay marriage and all that sort of stuff. The other one, of course, being your colleague from Saskatoon. Stephen Harper made it pretty clear during his time as Prime Minister and as leader that, you know what, there's some things we're just not going to talk about. We're not going to reopen the debate. Should you win the leadership and become the Prime Minister, I mean, that's what this is about. Do you echo that position or do you have sort of a different perspective?
Well, I think through several party conventions and, of course, the dynamic in caucus, there are some of those issues that there's not really an appetite to revisit or to open up. A lot of the change that will come on those issues will come from outside Parliament. There's a lot of organizations that are doing that now. I'm a big believer in the rights of individual backbench MPs. When I was Speaker, I did my best to empower individual MPs and to make sure that their ability to represent their conscience or their constituents was protected as much as the standing orders allowed me to. So, you know, I think it's important for any leader of a caucus to implement his or her vision for what the government should do as a government, but to always allow that strong role for individual MPs.
Okay, it's fair enough. You say there's outside groups that'll continue to apply pressure. There are individual MPs who are free to presumably bring forward private members' motions and try to advocate for some of these issues. I'm not hearing you say that as Prime Minister, the government would initiate another debate, as the Supreme Court told the government to do all those years ago in the Morgenthaler decision, where the Supreme Court said, you know what, it's up to Parliament to set some restrictions on the abortion thing. That's not up to us, and Parliament's fully within its right to do so. Justin's claim, notwithstanding, that abortion is a charter right, that's not what the Supreme Court said. The Supreme Court said Parliament should deal with this. Is Parliament going to deal with it if you become leader?
Well, you raise a very good point that a lot of politicians have read things that were not there in the original decision. Parliament did deal with this subject matter last Parliament. We had a Conservative MP bring forward a motion. It was a backbench MP. Our party has a free vote on these types of issues. But, you know, when you think about the likelihood of legislation on this issue succeeding, the Liberals used to have a pro-life caucus. There used to be a dozen or two pro-life Liberals who would work with pro-life MPs from other parties, and there was kind of that probability of success might have been a little bit higher on some issues, depending on the year. You know, we're looking now at a situation where those MPs just don't exist. So for any Prime Minister to kind of consider what type of legislation would be likely to succeed and to get members of Parliament who are sympathetic to the issue, it's not likely that in the short term that legislation on this type of subject matter would be successful. So I guess my whole point is, you know, are there other areas where we can make inroads? You know, would it be protecting conscience rights for physicians and nurses? Would it be perhaps a strategy to find women who are in situations where they feel like they don't have a choice but would like to keep their child? And is there a role for the federal government to work with the provinces to provide those types of safe places for them to go to? Those are the types of things that I think are achievable in the short term while keeping conservatives of all different stripes united. So I go back to kind of the original point that I think the caucus and the party have been clear over the past few years that as a government, this type of issue should not be revisited. There are other types of things that we can do, and a lot of social conservative policies are in the platform, have been inserted in the platform very recently, and were implemented in legislation in the last few years of the Harper government.
Okay, beyond those issues, what else does Andrew Scheer bring to the table, just as a more broad candidate?
I really do think that there are areas that we can achieve inroads on, you know, and if someone were to bring in a piece of legislation tomorrow or a campaign on it in the next election, the likelihood of success would be very low. I think your listeners would agree that that type of approach so far hasn't worked, and I think some hearts and minds have to change around the country and in every region for that type of thing to be successful. So are there other things that we can achieve in the short term? And I really do think there's a growing appetite in Canada for protection of conscience rights. When you look at the last debate we had on euthanasia in the House of Commons, the Conservative Party was really making a strong case for physicians and nurses who could not persist in ending a human life because of their deeply held beliefs. We need stronger protections for that. The medical community, people of all different faiths within the medical community are expressing to us that they feel that their rights are not being protected, that they could lose their job, they could lose their accreditation if they don't participate in some procedures that violate their conscience rights. And I think that's something that has been lost in the debates in the last 20 years. The rights of people to live their faith or live their beliefs in the public realm have been greatly diminished. So I'd like to work with my caucus and draw some lines around what people in the medical community are forced to do, especially this new ruling on euthanasia. I would work very hard on that. And I think looking at some of those areas, family-friendly tax cuts, assisting parents who have children or would like to have more children, those are things that unite social conservatives and fiscal conservatives. You know, and I always joke I might have to recuse myself when we vote on family-friendly tax cuts or child tax credits because having five children of my own, it might look self-serving. But I really do believe that's important for society and for Canada to have families feel like they can have that choice to have children and have more children if they've already had some. So those are the types of things that are obviously socially conservative, but also fiscally conservative and can keep the caucus united. So, you know, I'm a Western Canadian MP, so I've got a lot of policy positions that I believe are important and appeal to the conservative membership, you know, vociferously against a carbon tax. I'm also from Ottawa originally. I grew up in Ontario, so I'm very aware of some of the issues going on in Ontario right now with carbon taxes and skyrocketing power rates. So, you know, these are the types of issues that conservatives can really focus on that will not only have a good impact on the economy, but a very positive impact on Canadian society.
Sir, thank you very much.
You bet. Thank you very much.
And that's it for the program this week. Since we've now crossed over into September, we're done with the summer production schedule for Lighthouse News. That means we're back to weekly delivery of the program. Next show due to be posted next Tuesday, September 6th. You should also know that we're expanding the options for you to get your Lighthouse News information. Starting this week, we're doing written versions of most of the stories you're hearing on the podcast, along with transcripts of the feature interviews. All that information online at lighthousenews.ca.
This has been Lighthouse News, delivering news and commentaries on today's current events to equip Christians for their task in the public square. Questions or feedback?
You can leave us an audio comment by clicking on the answering machine button at the top of the Lighthouse News homepage, or you can send us an email, info@arpacanada.ca. Be sure to join us again next week for another edition of Lighthouse News.